The following is Keith Anderson's talk, Future Proofing Content, from the 2012 Information Architecture Summit.
The 2012 IA Summit podcasts are brought to you by User Interface Engineering and the UIE Virtual Seminar Program. Stay tuned after the podcast for a special offer from UIE.
Afternoon. This is the part where I have to tell you all to quiet down. Rowdy bastards. Everybody emerging from the post-lunch torpor. My name is Adam Polansky, and I'm introducing Keith Anderson, and he's going to be talking about something he's been actually talking about for a little while now. Keith is a UX practitioner with Sprint, and his and my universes cross in the context of the Big Design Conference in Dallas this June. Plug. If you've got something you want to do this summer, come on out. We've got barbecue and air conditioning. That said, everybody's sat. I'm going to turn it over to Keith.
Thanks, Adam. So who all brought a beer into this session? I'm disappointed with the whole lot of you. My name's Keith Anderson, and you'll notice that the hashtag for this particular session is future-proof content, and if you add that to my Twitter handle and the hashtag for the conference itself, you have very little room to say anything pithy. I suggest you try. So, who am I? Well, I started out as a tech writer nearly 20 years ago, and I've been a user advocate the entire time I've been working. And I've dealt in many different industries with content migration. So when it comes to future-proofing content, I've picked up a few tips and tricks along the way I'm going to share with you today. Future-proofing is the concept of making your content portable. I don't mean mobile, I mean portable. That means the content and its context can move from one platform to another. Back when I first started this thing, I ended up inheriting a documentation project where I had to do a document conversion. This was for a company called Axiom in Little Rock, Arkansas at the time, and they had a bunch of legacy documentation. And one of my jobs was hired to do migration from an old system to a newer system. And back then, a newer system was an AS400. But this was under everything that was in a Wang word processing system that we had. So we hired a guy that made a dongle that goes from a Wang word processor to the PC platform. And after we did that, we converted everything to WordStar. You guys remember WordStar? And then we went from WordStar to WordPerfect. That was the whole project. What happened in this project that I noticed first thing was that the markup didn't move across. The markup came across as gibberish. So any kind of formatting that was done in terms of necessary formatting, right, like italics, or something like that that was needed for emphasis, it was all lost. So the future's coming, and if I've learned anything over time, it's that you cannot avoid migrating documentation and content from one platform to another. It's gonna happen to you no matter what. So if you fear your future overlords, then the best thing that you can do is you can prepare for it. You need to hang on to your clarinet and hope to God that you have the skills to migrate stuff over.
Future! Future!
Yes, if you do this, then maybe you don't need to be working with content. So, first, I got to talk about content strategy, and I was afraid to put it up here because it's really an unfortunate buzz phrase now. It basically means nothing. People who are content strategists, I have found out, are ex-writers who just don't want to write anymore. But content strategy is something that you have to write out. I would say that content strategy is a written plan. is not a bunch of decorative text that hangs around your badass designs. A content strategy includes a classification system. And I'm going to go over classification systems in just a few minutes, but classification systems are very important for the life of all of your content. It also needs to include retention policies. If you work in an organization, especially if your organization is a publicly traded company, retention policies are highly important for legal and for federal oversight reasons. It also includes tactics for creating, editing, and implementing content. Tactics being that you assign roles to people and you have workflows of how the content should get published. That includes internal and external content. And finally, my favorite thing that your content plan should include are style guides. Style guides are the long lost Bible of how you should be implementing content. If you have a style guide at your company that was written by marketing communications, then all it does is tell you what to do with the brand and the company colors. That's not the style guide I'm talking about. I'm talking about a style guide that gives you answers to questions about usage, answers to questions about how pages are put together for a specific type of content. For example, I work at Sprint. A lot of documentation that I do is for Sarbanes-Oxley reporting. That content has to be created and delivered in a very specific way. We have a style guide just for Sarbanes-Oxley content. Now I want to go real quick and I want to talk about classification systems. I would argue that classification systems are the foundation for being able to manage content. If you have a classification system in your company already, then you know that you have limitations set on content and you have behavioral attributes assigned to certain types of content. Classification system is really a meta library that allows you to identify all your content types. And I mean everything from internal memos to email to marketing communication internally to public-facing content. It identifies all those, and then it assesses the risks. And risk assessment is very important in this world of corporate espionage. And if you work for a tech company, like a telecom company like I do, things leak. And things leak 5 to 6 months ahead of time, and they can be devastating financially. So there is a risk associated with certain types of content. It assigns actions to the content, and by actions, I mean if the retention policy on this content is 90 days, after 90 days, it gets destroyed. It's just as an example. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the Department of Defense. And before I start, I am not going to talk politics with any of you. I don't care how drunk you get later on tonight. Okay? I'm using the Department of Defense as a case study because I have background, because I worked with the Department of Defense previously, okay? And if one of you comes up to me later and says WikiLeaks, I'm going to smack you in the face. The Department of Defense was established in 1947, right after World War II. Now, it came from the War Department, but one of the key factors in the Allies winning World War II was dissemination of intelligence and learning how to manage intelligence information. So in 47, the people in the War Department, as they were forming the Department of Defense, they had hands-on experience with that. And then through a series of presidential orders over time, the Department of Defense has handled trillions of documents. Okay? Now, the WikiLeaks part. Just a couple of guys in today's world can ruin an entire system. We've seen that. But if you consider the history of the Department of Defense, you will know that they've done a pretty damn good job of managing these documents over a very long period of time. This was my first content manager I met when I was in the Air Force. this really sets the tone for how you handle that information. Now, you can't put this guy in your own company at the door, even though you want to. But what this does is this is an example of how culture influences content. When you buy into the Department of Defense culture, you buy into the fact that you could go to prison if you leak or you do something wrong with the content. When I first got in, I went to Cheyenne Mountain Air Force Base, and I was taken to a room with the guy that I went with, and we were shut literally in the vault and were handed a stack of papers while a guy stood over us and we read. And what I read was essentially a style guide for handling classified information. And this was the first time, this was my orientation into having top secret clearance. After I was done, when I signed off on a document that said, I have 75 years to keep my mouth shut about anything that I see that's classified when I'm working for the Air Force. So not only did I see this guy on my way in, but I was also treated to an orientation that made sure that I kind of understood the ramifications of taking my job seriously. So the Department of Defense has content management techniques that are built in. The first one is a background investigation. Now this sounds like maybe, well, how does this apply to my company? But a background investigation is very important to determine the trustworthiness of somebody who's handling sensitive information. If more companies did background investigations around, say, engineers who have a propensity for leaking things to Engadget, then they would have fewer problems. I know Apple does investigations, and other companies do. It used to be that in private organizations, the only people who had a background investigation were people who were bonded, like tellers and cashiers, people like that, or if they were in a paramilitary organization like police and fire. But background investigation is actually becoming a wider used technique by HR departments anyway. And in fact, if they go and you have a Facebook page that looks like you're still in college and having a really good time, that may be enough of a background investigation to keep you from handling sensitive content in some companies. Levels of clearance is another big part of this. Now, I know everybody has seen a movie where they talk about need to know. You know, you don't need to know that. Need to know basis. In reality, the Department of Defense segments employees' job roles so that if you have top secret clearance, you're in one area, and if you only have secret clearance, you could never get into that area. This is where, like, companies like IBM have R&D departments where the other employees can't get in. As an example, periodic reviews of personnel, and I don't mean like your HR review, I mean review the personnel and whether or not they still need access to the content that they have. The Air Force and the Department of Defense do this all the time, and if your job changes to where you don't interact with classified materials, you lose your clearance. Periodic reviews of content being managed. And that means that the Department of Defense looks at the entire organization that you're working for, making sure that the right kind of content that you're working with is still viable. Then what they do is they have a very thick set of rules. This is like I was talking earlier about the style guide. This is just one small example from a Department of Defense document. But this is the level that they go to spell out how you're supposed to handle the content. And it goes and it talks about the markup, which is like top secret. And then if there's any kind of restriction beyond top secret, you put it on there also. Everything has a purpose. And they have it in the format they want because they know that when I have a document that looks like this on my desk, it means this. Obviously, the assassin team that I hired to take out Dana Chisnell didn't do their job. And it's $10 I am never going to get back. Culture is a really important part of content management. And the thing about corporate culture is it exists whether it's deliberate or not. Now, if you have a culture like Zappos, for example, that's completely manufactured and deliberate culture, okay? If you have a culture that no one is nurturing, and you might find that, you know, coming out of that culture is some difficulty when it comes to managing content and people not taking your content role seriously. But your culture, if it's deliberate and you make content part of everything else that's part of that culture, you have a really good handle on it. So what? So what does this mean? Why are we talking to the Department of Defense? Well, they're a really good case study and an example of how to model something for a private or a publicly held organization. The best way to apply this to the real world is to look at what you have going today and what the risks are for that content. If you haven't sat down and looked at who's creating content, what content's being created, how is the content being disseminated, who's reading it, is there a retention policy, then you're not actually doing content strategy. By the way, I really believe this is true. Companies are begging for oversight when they don't watch themselves. I mentioned Sarbanes-Oxley earlier because I do a lot of that at Sprint. Which company is really responsible for Sarbanes-Oxley? Anybody know? One company. Enron. That act went into place as a direct result of one company's actions. And notice that the law didn't do anything when it came to the banking bailout and all that stuff, the failure of the banks. So there's going to be more federal oversight of these companies because companies try to find ways around this stuff. Now, if you're an ethically run company and you behave in an ethical manner, the chances are likely that you won't need that. But if you work in telecom, if you work in banking now, if you work in a publicly traded organization, there is federal oversight, and federal oversight will be part of the job. Sarbanes-Oxley is there now, and it has a specific way that things have to be reported. So I've talked about culture, and I talked about the way that culture and content work together. Now I'm going to kind of get into some of the nuts and bolts of the other part of future-proofing content. So you have content, and you also have assets that go along with it. And so you have pictures, you have maybe media, you might have some other things that go along with your content, and so you need tools to help you with those. For example, me personally, I use Adobe Lightroom and Paperport for all of my side stuff that I do with clients. Lightroom is a heavy-duty photo management software, but I have so many photos to manage, I need something, and I need something to manage the metadata with those. So I have a collection of that stuff on hard drives, and then I have content that goes along with them. And then I had, a few years ago, decided to move from PostNuke to WordPress. And how many of you guys know what PostNuke is? Yes? No? Just an older content management system. And it turned to Zicula, and then most of the lead developers left. So I was stuck with this crazy PostNuke database. So in here, you'll see I took what is essentially two parts to a single article. This was the lead, and this was the body. And then an article ID there on that one is 82. And a buddy of mine named Fred wrote code to migrate it into WordPress. At the same time, I wrote some other code so that I wouldn't lose my SEO juice because I had a pretty high ranking with my blog, and I wanted those article numbers to correspond with new article numbers, and I wanted it to tell Google when it hits the page, this is the new link forever. So I had to do that. So I'll get to that in a second. The reason I'm telling you all this is because migrating content, even for a small blog like I had, became a giant nightmare of trying to figure out how to move it from one place to another, keeping my SEO rankings where they were, and also dealing with the content as it was. So I get it into WordPress, and I find all kinds of happy little surprises with WordPress. Now, this is the PostNuke repository, and if you notice, I've got markup in here, right? And it's stored in the database, all the markup I need. That link, as long as it's alive on the internet, you know, will remain a live link. When I go to WordPress and I write an article, there's no markup. Because what WordPress does is it puts the markup of your content, it creates it on the fly, and it's at the presentation layer. So this is very frustrating for me because I think, from my experience, WordPress isn't always going to be what I use. Because one day, something's going to happen to it. Somebody is going to go back in time and kill WordPress's mother or something, and I'm not going to be able to use WordPress anymore. But what do I do with this content that doesn't have markup? Well, the markup is not in there because of, you know, their HTML WYSIWYG editor. It removes all the markup. And they wanted to make WordPress so friendly that all you have to do is type and hit return, and that gets translated into a paragraph whenever it's displayed on the fly. On my blog, I have this list that's unfinished of albums that I really like. And let's say I'm deciding to move WordPress from this. I have a plugin that generates that list. Behind the scenes in the database, the paragraph is there, and that represents that list. So what happens if WordPress evolves so much that that plugin no longer works? That's happened. And so you start to think about how you're putting in content in such a way that you can keep it forever. Does that mean I need to go and then manually make that list? No. I'm going to say that the plugins make so many things convenient, but their purpose really is to keep your content in WordPress. I mean, they really want you to stay within the WordPress platform. But what I've been working on for a while, and this is before I got ill and I kind of dropped it, but I want to get back to finishing this project, was doing an HTML snapshot plugin for WordPress so that it would store in a separate database table the content as it's presented to the user. Does that make sense? Because what the user sees is created on the fly by WordPress, and when that happens, it should be stored somewhere else and it should have a content ID with it so that that's the content that I move over to somewhere else. And this is the kind of consideration that you want to take conceptually to larger organizations. For example, at Sprint right now, we're going to SharePoint. God help us all. And that's where everything's going to be. And they are actually, and I'm not part of the project, I'm just going to be an end user of this one, but I am watching as they are seeing what happens when you have an entire document management system with no metadata, how you migrate that. Because the way that it's stored right now in our current system is in a series of folders. And there's no metadata assigned to anything because nobody's forced to enter metadata when they store things in the system. And now they're realizing that they've got to make SharePoint do that, but SharePoint doesn't do that natively. So we'll see how that happens. So I hope I kind of gave you guys some ideas to take back with you on how to future-proof stuff. It just requires a lot of thinking and planning and identifying and then actually writing out your content plan. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to move to questions now. Ask me. We do have a microphone in the middle.
Places and some buildings with some shapes, there are photographs of the person outside of their door so that when you walk by their door, you know if the person in there is other than who should be in there looking at the document that looks a certain way.
Yeah.
Is there any way that we can, I'm really fascinated by using DoD as positive reference examples, because I see so many negative ones. Is there ways that we can somehow, through metadata, associate appropriate use with the document without actually affecting the content?
Yeah, there's some technology ways to do it. We implemented Adobe Lifecycle a while back, and it has a workflow add-on that's very powerful, and it actually uses encryption when you need it to, so that a reviewer or a content creator is the only one who can do that, or actually edit it and review it and then produce it later. The whole purpose of doing the encryption piece is if it's going out to the public, then it's encrypted up until the point that it's finalized and then published.
Does anyone else have any questions?
Thanks for your talk. At the beginning, you mentioned content types, and that was a key part of classification.
Yes.
Identifying those content types. And I just wonder if you have any suggestions or how to approach that. I'm working on a project where the owners of the current version of the intranet have categories which make sense to them. They have things they call bulletin boards. They have things they call alerts. They have things they call news. But we can't just move those forward. That's kind of, that's sort of the history of the organization. So I just wondered if you have any suggestions on future-proofing in that sense.
You know, it's one of those things where you end up normally creating a taxonomy and then drawing a line in the sand. This is what this means. You know, you can have larger categories first, you know, that say like public-facing, internal only, and then underneath that, you can have different things like time and attendance records, employee news. You can have qualifiers against news, obviously, and break them down to what they actually are. And if something like the higher level classification that you give it, like if it's public-facing or internal use only, that should override any other of the subcategories. So if it does leak out after being internal only, then you have that to use as well. Does that help?
Thanks. It's a good talk, very interesting. And I'm going to feel your pain for SharePoint because we implemented that and it wasn't good. But my question was, when you're dealing with a lot of content, you had an example, a personal example of wanting to try and keep the markup. When you're dealing with a large site where pages could be created on the fly, do you feel keeping the markup separate at that point is essential? Because if we're looking at that, content is water and flowing around things.
You know what, I didn't explain that probably good enough. There's certain markup that should always stay with it, right? It's like if you're citing something, or if you have a book title, or if you have something in there, that markup should always stay with the text. And then there's the presentation layer of your system, and that has the markup of the whole system. And that definitely should be separate. Okay, so the markup that I'm talking about should be very specific to the context of the content that you're working with.
Not to sound like too much of a smartass, but are there steps that you take to future-proof your actual taxonomies and the sort of content strategy itself?
Well, what you have to do there is write it down first, because if you don't, it doesn't exist. And then, like everything else, you put a date on it that it has to be re-reviewed. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So if you need to re-review your content plan a year from now or review it annually, you do so, and that way you keep it current. Because any kind of plan that you write should reflect reality. When reality changes, either your plan changes or you have to change the reality back to the plan.
Yeah, I'm also sort of wondering about continuity when people leave organizations or when there's kind of turnover, and how, if there are steps that you feel are best practices for maintaining continuity through those things.
I do it by role, not individual names. So whoever is fulfilling this role is associated with that particular function in the content plan.
You should go talk to UC Berkeley about that.
Any more questions?
So who should own the content, and how do you deal with that?
Well, you know what? That's a great question that I can't answer, because the tech writers of the world are still arguing over how they're supposed to handle things. UXers have inherited content when they don't want it. IA folks want to handle strategy, and there's very few people who actually want to write. Okay? So you end up with very fragmented scenarios in corporations, especially when you have a marketing communication department, and they think that they own all the content, and they don't understand that there's content outside of just communicating in an ad or just communicating in a retail store or something like that. So really, it's almost like companies need a chief content officer, and they need a hierarchy under them for true content strategy. Okay, I know that that's not realistic, but you know, one day I will be that guy. I promise.
How did that work in the Department of Defense?
The Department of Defense has people who manage the classification systems, and they have to. They're assigned to because the classification systems in the Department of Defense come directly from presidential orders. And so when you have a presidential order, you assign a bunch of people to carry that order out. Corporations don't have that luxury of an unlimited budget to do that. But I also think corporations and small companies, they don't think about content at all. They just think that content's going to just happen.
I do a lot of content type design, and I'm wondering, a lot of times we use like kind of a catch-all rich text field, and it kind of catches everything that doesn't have a spot in terms of the content type fields. So it's like the body of the page, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any thoughts or tips on kind of where and how to cut back on that, like how to minimize that and make things more portable in kind of a modular way?
It'll take human beings to do it. You know, so you need some kind of technology, obviously, that would capture that. But nothing beats humans looking at reviewing content and approving it to go into whatever final state that you want it to go into. It needs a reviewer, basically.
So a lot of what I'm hearing sounds an awful lot like a problem that's kind of all across a lot of areas, which is there are folks who love to build or think about the beginnings of organization, but when it comes down to the day-to-day housekeeping of doing it, the librarianship, et cetera, and the management of it, nobody wants to do that part, which is how we get these piles of stuff. We have SharePoint, we have other means of organizing stuff with great features and functions, but really the problem is what happens 6 months, a year down the line when everybody's been pouring stuff into this and nobody's been making sense out of it. And now people need to retrieve stuff and they can't. Have you seen or could you think of any rationale that you could give within a company? What's the real pain point you have to create or get somebody to understand to say, yeah, this isn't really sexy. This is something that needs to be done. It's a lights on kind of thing. What can you think of to really nail that point home to get someone to do it?
I would assign dollars to content. In the same way, the Department of Defense actually assigns lives to their classification system and to justify that, you know, this particular document is top secret for this reason. You know, and we saw a lot of that with the Walker family in Vietnam. Literally, the information that they leaked from the Navy did cost tens of thousands of lives because it was handed directly to Soviets who then gave it to the North Vietnamese at the time. And I found that when you kind of take the same approach with money and corporations, that's the one thing that they do understand company-wide. And so you have a project where you have content piling it up, then you create the need by creating the position of having to take care of all of this. And it's going to cost this much money. If we don't do it, it's going to cost this much more money.
Do you have an idea about what would be the best content management strategy, I mean governance strategy? Like outside of an organization like D&D, no? For a public sector organization, what would be a good content governance strategy like? Splitting of responsibility for the content. Because I agree with you that nobody wants to be accountable for it, but we would like to improve the situation. So we would like to establish a kind of governance around it.
Well, that's what your content strategy plan really is. It's what you make it to have that happen. And if you need roles and you need people to be part of it, you put that in the content plan. You know, it's just like with any other business plan, the content plan should work the same way. This is what we're going to be like in a year or 2 years or 3 years, you know, on out. And these are the kinds of people that we need, and this is the budget that we need. that's how I would handle that in the content plan, because once you start writing it down, anything down, you're going to actually put people who are decision makers in a position to make decisions that they wouldn't make otherwise. If you don't write it down, they never have to face that decision. Anyone else? Well, thank you so much for coming.
Thanks for listening to this podcast from the 2012 IA Summit. The IA Summit podcasts are sponsored by the UIE Virtual Seminar Program, with scores of online seminars your team can access on demand. For free access to a virtual seminar, visit uie.com/IAS12. And you can find the rest of the IA Summit podcasts at library.iasummit.org.